Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, COVID-19 cases are soaring and hospitalizations continue to reach new highs in North Carolina. Face mask regulations are strengthened and instituted in more places, even as health experts say citizens aren't taking this seriously and in the process are jeopardizing our economic recovery. President Trump and his education secretary demand schools reopen their classrooms this fall. We'll tell you where North Carolina and CMS stands. Another Confederate monument comes down, this time in Salisbury, as debate over a different monument takes place in Gaston County, and Charlotte City Council focuses on stopping violence and reforming police. And here to talk about all of that and more are four of our favorite people on the news roundup. Ann Doss Helms is here. She's our education reporter here at WFAE News. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Mm-hmm. Katie Peralta is also with us. She's senior editor at the Charlotte Agenda. Good morning to you, Katie.
Good morning.
Nick Oxner is from WBTV, where he is investigative executive producer. Welcome back.
One of the nicest things anyone has ever said of me, Mike.
What, that you're executive producer of investigative reports?
No, that we're all one of your favorites.
Okay. I'm glad to say it. And Glenn Birkins is here. He's the founder and editor, publisher of QCityMetro.com. Welcome back, Glenn.
Good morning, Mike.
Well, the coronavirus has its eyes set on the South, where cases of this virus are exploding here in North Carolina. I think we have more than 79,000 cases. 2,039 of those cases were recorded yesterday, which marked the 16th day in a row that we have seen a single day increase of more than 1,000 cases. And meanwhile, the number of hospitalizations related to COVID-19 rose to a record for the fourth straight day, crossing the 1,000 mark for the first time on Thursday. And State Health Secretary Dr. Mandy Cohen, says all of this reflects on how overall metrics continue to head in the wrong direction.
Our state needs to stabilize these trends in order to avoid a dangerous spike in the virus that could overwhelm our medical system and risk us going backwards, like so many states are doing right now.
I take it this is the worst we have done so far. Do they understand why? Can they attribute this to the protests or to something else, or just laziness on our part, not social distancing, et cetera? Katie.
Health officials were asked this exact question yesterday. You know, can you point to one specific event or mass gathering that is sort of causing these pops in numbers? And they really can't. It wasn't the protests. The numbers were rising weeks before that, in fact, around the time of Memorial Day when businesses started reopening. But things have gotten exponentially worse over the last few weeks, and they can't really pinpoint one specific event. And so I think it's a culmination of course, we're doing more testing, but that's not the only reason why there are more confirmed cases. It's, you know, people, I think, getting just sick of this and kind of deciding that it's over. A lack of social distancing. We are back to around the levels of social distancing that we were at essentially around the stay-at-home order when that was issued. So I think it's a culmination of a lot of things that is that are making the situation here in North Carolina pretty dire. And this comes roughly a week before North Carolina is supposed to enter phase three of reopening next week, I think July 17th. So it will be very interesting over the next several days to see if these trends actually do improve and we can move into that next phase. But it doesn't look good right now.
And Nick, I know you want to comment on this, but let me add something to this question. And that is we're about to move into phase three, or we're supposed to be. But the staying in phase two was delayed by the governor a couple of weeks ago. Did he see this coming? Is this why we're still in phase two?
I don't think we ever actually had a decrease in cases. It's important to look, when you look over time, North Carolina's never really had the graph going in the right direction. Yes, are people going out to bars in South Hendon and packing them on a weekend contributing to the spread? Absolutely, yes. But you have to look at what all else is going on in North Carolina, and that's the continued outbreaks in places like meatpacking plants, nursing homes, prisons, all the congregate facilities, close quarters facilities, other manufacturing areas. And North Carolina still has not gotten a handle on these hotspots and controlling that. And we know a big part of that is because we still are not testing enough people. We're doing, if you look now, maybe between 15,000 and 20,000 on a good day tests. And that is not nearly enough that we need, because you can't control this virus until you identify it and then properly contact trace to isolate people. And we still don't have a robust enough network set up. And until we do, the virus is going to continue to spread.
And if we had enough testing, would we have enough contact tracers to make this effective?
So we don't have enough testing and we don't have enough contact tracers.
So there's a lot of cases out there that we don't know about, and yet people are out there congregating, as you said, Nick, on weekends and going to bars and having a good time, because it's easy to step back into the old world because that's where we gravitate. But Gibby Harris, Mecklenburg County's health director, says ordinary people in the community need to step up to get this under control.
Unfortunately, I'm watching what's happening in other communities and how quickly this can change, and it concerns me greatly. I don't think that our community is taking this as seriously as I would like them to. I mean, don't get me wrong, there are some who are, and there are many who are doing what we're asking, but there are many who are not.
So for those who are not, is it just easier to live the old life that we've always lived? Is it because of the increased politicization, if that's the word, of COVID-19 and all of its surrounding paraphernalia like masks? Is it stubbornness? Is it ignorance? What's going on here, Ann?
Yes, it's all of those, I think. And we talked very early on when this started, we said on this show that the more effective prevention measures are, the harder they would be to sustain over the long term. If you stay home and you don't get sick and your family doesn't get sick and it's been 2 months, 3 months, you feel like this isn't that big a deal. I'm going to get out. And it is a political thing. I've also said on this show, I live in Gaston County. We had some real, you know, political drum beating of we need to reopen. You know, we don't need to wear masks. This isn't our problem. And it used to be when we were going out, we would see a lot of people without masks in Gaston County. And Gaston County is seeing a huge surge of cases. So, you know, it's still spotty. I think whether it's Charlotte or Gaston or whatever, the time and the place makes a difference. But I am seeing now more people wearing masks, kind of realizing, oh, yeah, we can't just proclaim this away. I remember you kind of yelling at the end of one show about how can you be political about science? And, you know, yeah, it turns out, you know, you can't just pontificate away the virus.
Glenn.
Yes, I agree wholeheartedly with everything that has been said. I recently had a relative fly out of Charlotte into LaGuardia, and she said it was night and day in terms of social distancing that was in place at LaGuardia versus Charlotte. The terminal was a lot less full. There was no social distancing. There was no effort at social distancing. The flight was absolutely packed. We just don't seem to take this as seriously as we should. And I think all of those reasons that you gave are spot on.
Around the country, we're hearing reports that it is younger people, and we're talking about really young people, like 18 to 25 now, who are getting this and are being hospitalized by this. Is the same true here? I know that younger people are being more affected, but is it getting younger in Mecklenburg County and Gaston County and the environs? Anybody know?
We know that across the state, they're getting younger. If you look at the average age, or the age, excuse me, of people under 18 has doubled that are infected. But again, it's not clear if it's because these people are going out without masks on, or if because family members are bringing it home from work. And I think it's no one has yet to pinpoint and trace that back for us. And so I think it's speculative at best to even try to guess where that.
One of the most political aspects of this, of course, is the wearing of face masks. And in the face of a steepening trajectory of COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations here, Mecklenburg County leaders have instituted new, stricter face mask requirements. What are they?
you now, this as of this week, they've mandated that people wear masks inside government building or county-owned buildings and at county park facilities, even in towns where that have not mandated that. If it's a county property, you need to wear a mask.
How is this different from what the governor ordered recently?
So the governor's order does not require you to wear a mask basically anywhere outside. Now, he would say it does. I think that's because their message is you should always wear a mask. But there's nothing in the language, and we had county commissioners raise this question right after the executive order was issued. There's nothing in it that says you need to wear a mask outside. And his order also says you don't have to wear a mask if you can stay 6 feet away from someone. I think the county's goes a little bit farther in saying, you know, you need to wear a mask in a park. For instance, you need to wear a mask whether or not you're within 6 feet of somebody. And the enforcement measure in the state executive order is really only focused on businesses and not on individuals. So I think this just takes the governor's executive order and walks it a little bit further.
Glenn.
Yes, as a footnote to that, the World Health Organization just yesterday confirmed that the virus can linger in the air, particularly inside, and that is a source of a spread. The WHO had been reluctant to go that far. And the other thing that that it pointed out yesterday, revised its stance on, was that people who are asymptomatic can and are transmitting this virus in a way that we probably aren't fully aware of.
If health officials nationally and health officials here, both statewide and in Mecklenburg County and elsewhere, have said and know that wearing a face mask reduces the spread of the virus and can protect you and particularly other people around you from getting this virus, why aren't they mandating this with fines? They keep saying it's hard to enforce. I keep going back to all the other things that we have on the books that we enforce. Jaywalking could be enforced. Running red lights is enforced. Why is this hard to enforce?
First of all, there are a number of exceptions, as we've talked about. I mean, you know, if you're exercising, if you're a child, you know, if you have a medical condition. Beyond that, I mean, who's going to do the enforcing? You know, is it going to be the police? Is it going to be the police in this moment where tensions between the community and law enforcement are already very high? They've said, you know, health officials, state officials have said very clearly from day one that it is extremely difficult to enforce. Now, I think the question here is like, why not just try, or why not just say that there's some sort of fine for people who don't, you know, heed this violation. You could walk through any, you know, crowded, you know, brewery bar in Southend or Plaza Midwood or NoDa and find, you know, probably hundreds of people if you wanted to. But I think it's just very unclear as to who the burden should fall on.
And well, fines are being levied in other communities around the Mecklenburg County, and we'll talk about that in a second. It's, as we say, this is one of the most politicized aspects of all this. And Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, who is running to unseat Democratic Governor Roy Cooper, spoke at a July 4th event claiming that, quote, multiple comprehensive studies have all said for decades, masks do not work. And he says the government pretends it can protect us from things like viruses. And then he said,
we have leaders that aren't telling us the whole truth, that aren't giving us all the data, that aren't sharing the whole picture, that are not telling us what the end game is and what it looks like and what they're expecting Americans to do.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to talk about that, because it sounds like he's talking about Donald Trump. Is he? I doubt it. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and it's the weekly news roundup with Ann Dawes-Helms here from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from QCityMetro.com, Katie Peralta from Charlotte Agenda, and Nick Oxner from WBTV News. I want to repeat the cut we just played from Dan Forrest, because that break kind of snuck up on me, and he was speaking at a July 4th event when he said,
"We have leaders that aren't telling us the whole truth, that aren't giving us all the data, that aren't sharing the whole picture, that are not telling us what the end game is and what it looks like and what they're expecting Americans to do."
This is precisely what health professionals have been saying for months. Again, Dan Forrest is a Republican. Is he in agreement here with these professionals? Is he talking about the Trump administration? What is he saying?
Well, he's pretty clearly trying to take aim at Cooper and the Democrats. And what he's saying is actually an example of information not presented in context. It is true, I think, that you cannot just wear a mask, do nothing else, and prevent the virus. You know, the masks alone have never been touted as the solution. But there's also been a consistent message, actually not consistent. There has been some inconsistency as knowledge about this virus has evolved, but there seems to be a consensus now that masks are an important part of the prevention effort. So it's politicizing this.
And in an interview with the Henderson Times News, Forrest said that, quote, "masks don't work with viruses, and that's why we've never used a mask for a coronavirus ever." But that is not what epidemiologists are saying. And in fact, they are insisting that the more we learn about the virus, the more we understand that it is being spread through the air. So why? He's angry about this. Why such a pushback on something so simple? It's a mask.
Well, he's not the only one, Mike. At Monday City Council meeting, Ed Driggs, City Council member Ed Driggs, also questioned the effectiveness of masks. And suggested that health officials aren't being above board about the mask and their ability to stop the spread. As you said, there is a group of people on both sides, frankly, but who have decided that this is a political issue, and they just simply see it differently, and they're willing to stand up for what they think is right, whether that matches up with what the data tells us or whether it matches up with what the medical experts are telling us.
I think that it also doesn't help that at the beginning of this outbreak, there wasn't consistent messaging about the effectiveness of masks, and there wasn't consistent messaging about the need for masks. And I think that at first they were saying, you know, we need to save masks for healthcare professionals who right. need them. And they were actually referring specifically to N95 masks and the super, you know, professionally made masks, not, you know, not just a simple face covering, which anyone can frankly wear, anyone can frankly make easily on their own. But I think that that has sort of given ammunition to people who, you know, want to criticize the effectiveness of masks and the need for masks by saying, you know, you keep flip-flopping, which one is it? Yeah. So that certainly hasn't helped. But the message now is unequivocally, masks help if everyone wears one.
Nick?
The other problem with this, and going off the lack of information or lack of clarity that Katie just kind of talked about, is we hear, especially from Governor Cooper and his administration, you know, we're making decisions and telling you what to do based on facts and data. And then we have a reticence to actually release the underlying facts and data. Not saying they aren't doing things based on facts and data, but when you don't actually release all of it, or you only release portions of it, reminder, there's a lawsuit pending from 27 media outlets from across the state and the country for this underlying facts and data at the state level that they won't release and haven't released and refused to release for months. And so when you actually refuse to release the facts and data you say you're relying on, you allow a vacuum to create, and people are going to fill that vacuum with claims like masks don't prevent the spread of coronavirus.
This is one of the things, Nick, that you have made your bones on as a reporter, and you constantly rail against in favor of transparency and against opaqueness in government. From your experience, when governments don't release information that would be helpful to the public, What has been the overriding reason?
Well, a couple things. Either they want to hide wrongdoing. That's certainly probably the main motivating factor. Or in, and I don't think that's the case here, but what I do think is probably the case here is the government, at least the state government, doesn't want us to know the uncertainty or the, you know, the nebulous nature of the debate and the kind of frantic, you know, scurrying going on behind the scenes, right? It's hard to put out a message that says we know exactly this, we're absolutely in control, when in fact the underlying documents would show something else. In fact, we've started getting some documents in the lawsuit from the state to see how the state's been handling coronavirus. And we haven't published any of that yet, but the documents show exactly that while the state said they had everything under control, they really didn't. And sometimes through no fault of their own, sometimes through their fault. But they, you know, it, generally speaking, government is much messier and much less in control than they want you to believe. And so if we start releasing our documents, people are going to know that.
So it's Wizard of Oz syndrome. Yeah. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. I don't know how it works.
Yes.
Okay. Steve Harrison, our political reporter at WFAE, found another way that Dan Forrest is politicizing masks. You can go on Dan Forrest's website and buy a Dan Forrest mask for $15 on his campaign website. So there you go. You can wear Dan Forrest on your face if you'd like to. Meanwhile, face mask mandates are in place in Fort Mill, where the town council approved a mandatory face mask requirement for public areas within the city limits. And in Rock Hill, city leaders put a face mask mandate in place, which takes effect today, Friday. In Fort Mill, you can be fined $25 for not wearing a face mask. And if they get you the second time, it could be as much as $100. Are there fines in Rock Hill? And can this be, if it can't be enforced, how are they going to enforce this?
It's easier to enforce things like that in a municipal level, right? Where you have a very specific police department that can go do your enforcement versus implementing something on the statewide level or even the county level, like in Mecklenburg County. That being said, we'll see.
Johns Hopkins epidemiologist told the Washington Post that masks are an important component to stopping the spread of COVID-19, and health experts are now saying that face masks are our best tool in fighting the virus and could help save the American economy. And that's something that State Health Director Mandy Cohen recently echoed.
We now have growing evidence that cloth face coverings, when worn consistently, can decrease the spread of COVID-19, especially among people who are not yet showing symptoms of the virus. Face coverings are key to moving forward with getting our kids back to school and further easing of restrictions.
Do you think people have made that connection that we all want to get out of the house? We all want to go back to our regular lives. Certainly the economy needs to be restarted. People need to get their salaries back, those who've lost their jobs. Do you think they see this connection to doing whatever they tell us to do, if it's going to help get the economy back on track? Would that help?
No, it's because everything is hyperpolarized right now. People see this as one or the other. You know, you're either in favor of promoting economic growth or you're in favor of promoting physical well-being of the community. And in truth, like, if you help to prevent the spread of coronavirus by wearing a mask and social distancing, you will help to improve economic conditions, because that will lead to lower cases and our data will improve and businesses can open back up. But nuance is extremely hard to communicate in today's environment. And I think that that's a message that is just really difficult to kind of hone home to people who, are quite frankly sick of this. So,
and I'm not a doctor, but I'll play one on radio. It seems to me that this is a virus. It may never burn itself out before we get a vaccine, but the lower the exposure, the less opportunity it has to infect other people, the lower the incidences will be, the healthier we will become, both physically and economically. Am I wrong?
Exactly.
No, and I think that another important thing that you mentioned was wearing them consistently. I think that's been hard for people to figure out. I went to a meeting in Gastonia, which we'll probably talk about a little more later, but it was set up to be socially distanced and people walked in wearing masks and got the health screenings and all that. And went in and the tables were all spaced out. There was very limited public seating. And so everybody came in masks. But once we were in this big open chamber, yeah, a lot of people took off their masks. And I honestly don't know if that was risky or not. You know, they were not breathing right into each other's faces. I think most of the media, we kept our masks on, but most of the participants took them off. So I don't know how much was circulating, but I think you see things like that all the time. You know, when you walk into a grocery store, some people put their masks on as the minute they get out of their car, and some people wait till they're almost in the door to put it on.
A listener has written to say, you want to know what gets a 20-something to take it seriously? When their 84-year-old grandpa is on a ventilator. That does it. A lot of the same people who are resisting wearing masks are also pushing to open the economy quicker. And this week, Reopen NC co-founder Ashley Smith circulated the petition calling on state lawmakers to impeach Governor Roy Cooper over his orders restricting commercial activity because of this virus. What are the chances of this gaining any traction whatsoever, Nick?
That is such a non-serious thing. You didn't even hear the Republicans in the General Assembly who agree with Roy Cooper on exactly nothing talk about it.
The rise in the number of cases had Mecklenburg County commissioners musing about whether this county is on its way to another lockdown. But County Manager Dina DiIorio made it clear that is not on the table.
We're not in a position right now to say we're going to shut down the county again. I think we've learned a lot in the last 120 days. And shutting down the county is not necessarily going to stem it, because the minute you open it back up, we're going to be in the same exact place as we are today.
And she also stressed that our hospitals are in good shape and that they have now learned more about how to treat and deal with the virus. And that may be true, but if we're not careful, couldn't we find ourselves in the same position that Florida and Texas find themselves in right now, this morning?
So yesterday, Dr. Mandy Cohen said, was it yesterday? Man, the days run. Anyway, Dr. Mandy Cohen said that Mecklenburg County is, or Charlotte is of particular concern to state health officials because of, you know, the potential for overwhelming hospitals. So they've been in touch with, you know, Atrium and Novant periodically. And right now there's no imminent need to intervene for the state, but it is something that they're watching very closely. And to hear Charlotte called out like that specifically is always, you know, I mean, you know, we're the largest city in the state, but it is still a little jarring to hear, you know, we're concerned about you guys.
One of the things that everybody is concerned about is the schools. Dr. Mandy Cohen just mentioned it's on teachers' and parents' minds. It's looming large because the start of school is scheduled to be August 17th. We're not that far away. The president this week said that schools must reopen on time with classroom learning, or he would cut funding to the schools. And that was echoed by Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. Governor Cooper was going to announce what the state schools were going to do on July the 1st, but he held off. He's now going to make an announcement, I think, Ann, next week.
Yes,
that's right. Is everything at CMS and all the other county school systems waiting for that decision? And can they go against that decision? Because Phil Berger, yesterday, I think it was, in the state Senate, said that the first week of school everywhere will be in classrooms, period, full stop.
Yeah, and that's kind of an amazing thing to say, that when they passed the first round of legislation where they said August 17th for everybody, and they said there will be 5 days of remote learning, and they said the first 5 days cannot be remote learning. And I'm not sure why they did that. But what you're now looking at is the governor has a choice of three paths. And one is, it's really awful, everybody stays home, we're going back to all remote learning. Nobody wants to see that happen. That would be super unpopular. The other is, everybody goes back at 100% with some still pretty serious restrictions. But this middle path where you go back at 50%, which Charlotte Mecklenburg School says, that's what we're planning for right now. That's, we are making schedules, we are making plans, we're trying to lay out our staffing, because we can pivot either way from that if we have to. But their plan would be then that if they do that, a third of the kids would report that first week, and two thirds of them would stay home and start remotely. And then the second week, another third would come in, and then the third week, another, for this sort of rotating. And I know it sounds crazy to say divided in thirds when it's 50% capacity, but the schools are not all at 100% capacity. Some of them are at 130% capacity. So, yeah, so they're now looking at this and saying, okay, so if we have to go back at 50% capacity and we have to have all kids back in person, how does that work? And nobody knows.
And CMS is making its own plans, but then the governor is making his plans, I guess, with his Secretary of Education and his health director. Can local, every area of the state is different. As I think Nick just pointed out, Mecklenburg County is a concern for health officials, maybe a lot more of a concern than another part of the state. Will local school authorities be able to modify the governor's decision based on the health necessities that they face?
Yes, and one possibility that we could see next week is that Governor Cooper essentially makes this a local decision by choosing the least restrictive path, because they've said all along that if Governor Cooper, whatever the state chooses, you can't go more lenient. If the state says 50% capacity, you can't say, nah, we're doing 100%. But if the state says you're allowed to do 100%, local school boards or charter school boards can say we are going to have more serious restrictions.
So if the governor's making his announcement sometime next week about this, is CMS going to wait for that announcement? Because parents need to know something, it seems to me. They have to line up daycare and things like that.
Oh, believe me, parents are anxious, employees are anxious, everybody's anxious about this. But boy, you know, I saw one post on social media where people were going back and forth about the options, and somebody said, they couldn't make us all happy if they wrote us each a check for $1 million. And that is so true. The meeting where they discussed this, comments, there was almost 4 hours, comments were flying by, more than 3,000 comments. And for everyone that said, clearly the virus is so bad, we've got to keep everybody home. Then another person would say, clearly we've got to get kids back in schools. And somebody would say, this middle path is clearly the best answer. And somebody would say, this middle path is horrible. It's complicated and it's the worst of both worlds. So this is just not going to be an easy summer. I think President Trump said everybody wants to go back. And that is true with the asterisk, if it's safe. Yes, there are a million reasons to say it is really good for kids to be physically in school. But there are a lot of concerns about the safety, not just of the kids, but of the employees and the families that everybody goes home to.
That is the big question. The state and the federal government can say whatever they want to say about opening schools, but if parents are worried about the health of their children, they're not sending those kids to those classrooms. We'll talk about that when we come back, and also the fact that CMS at least has polled 19,000 employees about their willingness to come back, and we'll see what the results of that were and more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Glenn Birkins is here from QCityMetro.com. Nick Oxner from WBTV News. Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda. And Andos Helms from WFAE News, because it's the weekly news roundup. CMS polled 19,000 of its employees on whether they are willing to return in person to school this fall. The survey asks them to indicate whether they plan to report in person, seek a leave of absence, request a remote assignment, retire, or resign. Wow, that's a big decision. So when will the system have an idea of what people are willing to do?
Well, I believe they have said that those results are, the poll is due Monday. I'm not sure how many are answering it. I'm hearing from teachers that they feel like you're asking us to answer when we don't know what our working conditions are going to be. We don't know if we're going to be jam-packed in. We don't know if we're going to have some kind of spacing arrangement. Teachers have also pointed out that even under the middle path, the 50%, people may be less crowded, but they are still going to be exposed to the full number of students. The students will be exposed to a smaller cohort of classmates. But and with the, for instance, requesting the alternative assignment, I heard from someone who said, well, I indicated one of those and I got a form saying, well, now we need a doctor's report saying why you want this. And this is where it gets really complicated, because CMS has said to parents that you can choose remote only. We aren't going to, you know, put up a bunch of barriers. If you choose that, you can have a remote option for your child. But what if you're a teacher and you don't personally have a high medical risk, but you have a family member, or, you know, just you think of all the ripple effect reasons why you might say, I really don't feel safe going. And it's not just teachers, by the way, it's bus drivers, it's custodians. And when you hear them describe these plans, it sounds like they're going to need to like double their staff. I'm exaggerating, but you would
have
need
they
more
have
people.
They have they changed the cleaning protocol in some of these schools? Because I've been in schools and I wouldn't want to use the restroom. So have they changed the cleaning protocols?
They said they have. They said that's big, that it's doing a lot more of what they've done before, that it is, there are going to be hand sanitizers all over the place. There are going to be more air dryers for the hands instead of paper towels. There are going to be more
I'm not sure that is wise, because I have read many articles about these blower hand dryers, and what they do is they blow bacteria and viruses off your hands all over the room.
Well, that's something to think about. This is all really difficult. And they also said, oh, by the way, we have, I think, 66 vacancies for custodians right now. And that's out of a workforce of 800. So it's not as horrible as it might seem. But it's, you know, as opposed to having their full workforce and probably needing more, they have less than their full workforce. And we always see shortages with bus drivers. And one of the things that the state plan says is, ideally, you would also have an adult riding every bus to sort of enforce the social distancing that may be going on. And it would be great to be able to hire community members to do something like that, but I don't think there's any money for anything like that, is there a clear answer on whether they need to space out the bus.
We have an email from an anonymous teacher. It says the CMS intent form that we've been talking about really offered non-options. It asked if you wanted to quit, retire, come in as you are instructed by the principal, or be reassigned because you're in a high-risk group. So the option of actually saying that you are uncomfortable with being on site in a full classroom was not offered to the employees of CMS. I'm wondering if the parents have been polled by CMS. Elon University polled some parents and says the option of sending students back part-time drew the most support from respondees at 38%, followed by 34% of people saying they should return full-time and 29% advocating online education. So like everything else in America today, it's really tightly divided. This is going to be a major problem going forward. We'll talk about this, I'm sure, in the weeks to come. We're also witnessing this desire for testing of more cases. And I think this week, Dr. Cohen and Governor Cooper, the state secretary, Governor Cooper and Mandy Cohen, the state secretary of Human Services, changed the rules on testing. You no longer have to get a doctor's order to receive one. This was done in part, I'm told, to encourage more Black, Hispanic, and Native American residents to get tested. Why do they feel this is necessary for that to happen, Glenn?
Well, I'm not sure why they feel it's necessary for that to happen. I would say that in practical terms, there have been a lot of people who have been getting tested without a doctor's referral. Here in Charlotte, Atrium Health, Novant, they've both done mobile testing sites, and they have made clear that doctors' referrals are not required, preferred, but not required. Mm-hmm.
But in other parts of the state where the testing capacity is much more limited, and think like, let's use Chatham County, for example, that has a big Hispanic community. They work up largely in meatpacking plants, and the testing capacity, you know, it's just doesn't have the capacity of Charlotte. Mm-hmm. And so we were seeing that people couldn't go get a test. These are populations, because of what they do for a living and because we know there's a higher spread of the disease, that need the testing. The real question in my mind, Mike, is why this wasn't done sooner, and what finally led to the state realizing that we needed to issue this standing order.
I think the reason that they didn't do it sooner is what you just said, Nick, because of shortage of supply. And as you point out, in some parts of the state, getting tested is much more difficult than in others. We're very fortunate here in Charlotte. Testing is not it's not a problem here, but in some parts of the state, that's just not the case.
Nick, I have something that's near and dear to your heart to talk about for a moment, and that is the fact that this week Governor Cooper took an action. He vetoed Senate Bill 168. What would that bill have done?
Would have done a lot of things, but the problematic part of that bill would have made a lot of death records, records of death investigations from the medical examiner's office secret, including and specifically records of people who die in police custody or in jails. It's worth pointing out, Mike, Governor Cooper vetoed that at the last possible minute, hours before it would have become law without his signature. And days later, we saw charges of six jail workers, five officers and a nurse in Forsyth County for a man who died under pretty horrific circumstances at the Forsyth County Jail. And the first details of this released, even though they'd had all the details, man died 7 months ago. And so we've already seen some transparency as a direct result, I think, of this secrecy provision that was passed after midnight by the General Assembly being rejected.
Do they have the votes to override the veto? Because the governor, I believe, has asked for a clean version of a similar bill.
Well, so the thing that makes this even more interesting is that the governor issued his veto hours after the State House of Representatives, the House Rules Committee, passed a separate bill that would have allowed the rest of that legislation to become law and just would have repealed the secrecy provision. I don't believe the plan now is to override that veto. I think the plan is probably at some point to pass the rest of everything else that was in that bill that dealt with DHHS and some federal block grant funding and stuff like that, some really important stuff. So it's still not particularly clear why the governor ultimately vetoed the bill when the legislature was also working on a fix. This was a bill that was requested by the governor's administration in the secrecy language and was almost unanimously passed. One lawmaker voted against it in either chamber. Because of a lot of media attention and some scrutiny from protesters, people realized this was problematic. And so the General Assembly was already working to take this out. The governor ultimately vetoed. I think the veto will just stand, I think.
So speaking of law enforcement records, Charles Billing, the father of one of two people killed on the Bates Ford Road almost 3 weeks ago during the Juneteenth weekend, expressed anger this week over the lack of information that could lead to arrests of the people responsible, and he was angry at CMPD.
It happened 3 days in a row. Police department is half a mile from there. How could it happen 3 days in a row without anybody going and stopping it? I need the police to help me, fine, but how could it happen 3 days in a row? If it would have happened 2 days, my son and the rest of them would be still alive. So how did it happen 3 days? And you only a half a mile away.
CMPD has complained about the dearth of people coming forward in this incident, although I'm told more people have stepped forward. What have they said about their in response to Mr. Billings and the fact that he characterized the fact that there was this escalated street racing and dangerous driving going on and no police responded to that?
I've asked that question twice. I asked that media briefing where Mr. Billings spoke. It wasn't addressed there. I asked, I believe it was current Chief Jennings before he became chief about that. I think it was. He said that officers were preparing to stop the street racing and the spinning out the cars, doing donuts in the street right before it happened, that they were massing to put an end to it. So we've heard different things. What I would want to point out there is that CMPD has gone at that community very hard about the fact that no one has stepped forward. And I think we have to be careful because that is a very popular trope, if you will, about Black communities, that people don't come forward to help in these investigations. And that's simply not the community that I know. When you're in the dark and 200 rounds are fired within a very short period of time, you're not standing up to look at where they're coming from. You're hitting the ground. You're running. In fact, people were struck by cars, one killed, running from this chaos. So I think CMPD needs to be very careful about characterizing these communities as being unwilling to step forward, when it could be that people were so busy scattering and trying to save their own lives that they saw a lot less than CMPD realizes.
So much going on to talk about, and one of the things that's happening around the country is the fall of Confederate memorials, monuments, and statues. One came down in Salisbury after it was deemed a public safety hazard. It was taken down on Monday after having stood there for 100 years or more, and a small crowd was there to witness its removal.
Awesome.
Salisbury City Council unanimously voted to remove that statue, which will now be moved to the Old Lutheran Cemetery, where it will be stored. Meanwhile, a 12-person panel in Gaston County met on Tuesday to talk about the Confederate statue in front of the courthouse there and whether it should be removed. One member, Eric Riley, had a broad complaint about the way the Confederacy is being portrayed.
The racism issue is always laid at the feet of the South, always. My kids, your kids, everybody's kids in this room are being taught that your ancestors and the people that were born in the South were all racist scum and they need to be wiped off the face of the earth.
Another member of the task force, Cheryl Comer, said the monument was offensive and should be removed as a first step.
Is this just an exercise, or is this a true opportunity for us to look at our county and move away from white supremacy and be inclusive and diverse and put systems in place to change?
So we have a sensitive issue, yet another one here to deal with. I want to go back to Mr. Riley's comment. Is he correct when he says that the racism issue is always laid at the feet of the South?
Well, I was in that meeting, and one person responded with, "We aren't debating right now the history of the United States." I think most people would agree that, yes, racism was pervasive, not just at that time, but, you know, has never been just a Southern thing. But this panel member said, but we're discussing the memorial that's in front of the Gaston County Courthouse in Gaston County. And this person's comments had followed on a historian making a report that was very specific to that and reading a letter that very explicitly said, a speech, I guess, that was given when they laid the cornerstone that said, this is about, you know, preserving the white Aryan blood stream and, you know, very explicitly tying this to white supremacy in the early 20th century. So there were kind of people saying, well, but maybe this wasn't just about racism or it wasn't just the South, and it wasn't clear why that was relevant to this particular discussion.
I think anyone who knows anything about American history, and especially Southern history, know the or understand the political climate that was happening when these monuments were erected. They weren't erected to simply honor heritage. They were erected, starting with Reconstruction and going up through the Civil Rights Movement, to reassert white supremacy, to say to the aspirations of Black people, you may be free, but you are still in the South, where slavery was, where we fought for it, defended it, and we're not going to give up our positions of privilege so easily. Yes, racism is not a Southern problem, and I think everyone understands that. But in no other part of the country can you find the number of monuments to the Confederacy that you find here in the South. And I think that's what's being addressed right now. And not just the number of monuments, but the absence of monuments that tell the other side of that history.
Make a good point there. McCrae Dallas, before we go, McCrae Dallas, the man involved in the 9th District ballot fraud investigation, is running for re-election in Bladen County for the Bladen County Soil and Water Conservation District Board of Supervisors. It's a 4-year term on a 5-member board where he is currently the vice chairman. A person under indictment, Nick, yes or no, can run?
Yes, because they haven't been convicted of anything.
Okay.
He's running for his 3rd term on the board.
That's all we got. Nick Oxner from WBTV to get news. Glenn Berkins from Q City Metro. Katie Peralta from Charlotte Agenda. And Doss Helms from WFAE. Thanks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com.